I've been involved in this project on human cognition for the past couple of months, and one of the things that we've kind of repeatedly mentioned to each other during the course of this is that the problem with studying human evolution, this kind of classic problem, is that you've got an N of one evolutionary transitions, and that obviously presents a severe sort of problem for doing anything statistically. But I agree with Russell Gray, who's kind of set this up quite nicely for me, that one way of making general inferences about evolutionary phenomena and evolutionary processes is to use phylogenetic comparative methods to test hypotheses. And the phenomenon, one of the phenomena that I'm interested in, one of the evolutionary phenomena, is big brains. And I use phylogenetic comparative methods to study the ways in which brains have changed over evolutionary time, but not just brain size, looking at what has changed in terms of the structure of brains as brain size changes, and trying to infer from that something useful about the likely selection pressures and cognitive implications. Now, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the cortex, a little bit about the cerebellum and the interactions between them, but I want to start by sort of making the case that we've been overly corticocentric, that we are overly focused on the cortex as having been the site of all the interesting evolutionary action and being the kind of seat of human cognition. So is the cortex the intelligent bit of the brain? And the received wisdom, I think, is essentially that is the case. This presents a few problems, however. First of all, I mean, I don't like this idea for this reason. It sets up a set of rather problematic, I think, distinctions between executive and non-executive processes. I mean, it sounds kind of more vaguely scientific if you talk about executive and non-executive functions, or higher cognition. I'm never quite sure what lower cognition is, or what unintelligent processing is. But at any rate, there are these distinctions, implicit or explicit, and it's not clear to me that those are really useful, that they do any useful work or are meaningful. Secondly, in terms of the cortex, many, if not all, adaptive neural control processes recruit both cortical and subcortical structures. So it seems slightly artificial to isolate one bit of the brain and examine just that bit without understanding the way it connects to other brain areas. And indeed, in terms of brain evolution, when we take a close look at the patterns of brain evolution, what we find is a rather more complex and nuanced story than just the kind of progressive expansion of the cortex, which is the kind of folk wisdom model for human evolution. And it's the latter that I'm really going to focus on in this talk, but be trying to draw out implications for the first two issues as well. Now, on the face of it, it might seem that I'm onto a bit of a loser here, because if you just look at brains of different species, what's really, really striking is the variation in the size of the cortex. Cortical ballooning isn't a new kind of adventure sport, by the way. It's what happens when brains get bigger. So little things like shrews with their little brains have a very small proportion of their brains made up of the cortex, about 14% in the case of the shrew. Monkeys, obviously, they're big-brained, and the cortex has come to occupy not 70 to 7%, that should be 70 to 75%, and up to humans, whose cortex occupies 80% of our brains. And if you look across different mammalian orders at the proportional size of the cortex and the cerebellum, I hope you can see this at the back, but the red bars are the proportion of the brain that's made up of the cortex, the green bars, the proportion that's made up of the cerebellum in volumetric terms, then, as I say, you'd think I was backing a loser by saying there's anything interesting about the cerebellum, which doesn't seem to vary much at all as a proportion of brain size. It hovers around 10 to 15% of overall brain volume, whereas the cortex is immensely variable, and as we've seen, varies from, you know, about 15% right up to 70 or 80%. Now, I seriously think that just looking at brains in this kind of way, in this simplistic way, looking at the proportions of the brain, has somewhat led us up the garden path. It turns out that this variation in the proportions of the brain are to a large extent a kind of side effect of the way that things scale with overall size. And that, you know, this side effect is relatively uninteresting in cognitive terms, and may have little to do with any kind of specific cognitive selection pressures that we might be interested in. And, you know, this is really apparent if you start to broaden the comparative sample a bit more. Zebras, for example, also have rather a large proportion of their brain made up of cortex, 73%. Whales tend to exceed humans in terms of the proportion of the brain made up of the cortex. Now, it may be that zebras are, after all, as smart as monkeys, and that sperm whales have sort of deep inner spiritual lives, but a more parsimonious explanation is that these are just big animals, and that what we're seeing here is some kind of overall scaling process. And indeed, there is a pretty good relationship between the proportion of the brain that is cortical and overall brain size. Why should larger brains in larger animals have a greater proportion of cortex? Well, one of the reasons seems to be that for some reason to do with the way that the mammalian brain is wired up, an increasing proportion of the cortex is made up of white matter rather than grey matter as brain size increases. So there's a very good relationship between the proportion of the cortex devoted to white matter and the volume of the cortex. Basically, as it's getting bigger, it's having to devote more and more space to making connections. We don't fully understand the reasons for that, but it's probably something to do with long-range connections. The cerebellum, you don't get that to anything like the same extent. Again, this is the proportion of the cerebellum that is white matter. It's a much weaker relationship, a much flatter slope, and much less variation. And if we look at the consequences of this in terms of a measure which most people would believe was more directly related to information processing capacity than is volume, the density of neurons in the structures, what we see in the cortex is that as cortex size increases, density of neurons within it decreases relatively steeply, and much more steeply than is the case in the cerebellum. So bigger cortices have more white matter and lower neuron density. If we look at the more limited data on the absolute number of neurons within these structures, actually this is the percentage of neurons within these two structures, we see a very different pattern to the one we'd get if we were just comparing the overall volumes. So there's data for four mammalian orders here, and here the green bars again are the cerebellum, and strikingly, suddenly the cerebellum seems to be terribly important, certainly in terms of the numbers of neurons. And we also see that the variability in the cortex is much, much smaller than variability in cortical volume. So, you know, straight away I think there's reasons to doubt that proportional measures or ratios of the volume of one structure to another is going to give you an unbiased or a cognitively meaningful kind of measure of what's going on here. And it's also suggesting that the cerebellum has an awful lot of neurons in it. This diagram is just a it is just the cortex and the cerebellum as they appear in terms of volume, in terms of size. In humans, 70 billion neurons are found in the cerebellum and only 16 billion in the cortex. So if we actually redraw this diagram to represent the relative numbers of neurons within the structures, this is what your cerebellum would look like. So that's just a graphic representation of what your cerebellum should look like. Now, I'm the last person to say that all the variation in cortical size or the size of any particular brain structure is just a side effect of scaling. It's not. There is variation over and above that due to scaling. In particular, the neocortex, this is plotted against body mass, but if you plot these structures against brain size or the size of other brain structures, you find that in primates, which are these upper lines, primates do have a larger cortex than expected for their brain size. But interestingly, the same is true for the cerebellum. So I'm suggesting that there's something interesting going on here, not only with the cortex, but also with the cerebellum, and that you need to do proper scaling, properly scaled analyses in order to understand what it is that's going on. That kind of grade shift between primates and non-primates is also seen when we look at things in terms of the number of neurons. So primates are this green line and the blue squares in both of these plots for the two different structures. And you can again see there's a very similar kind of grade shift in the number of neurons relative to the number of neurons in the rest of the brain in these two structures. So this is all kind of pointing to the idea that the cortex and the cerebellum might have evolved together, at least at the origin of the primates. There was a conjoint expansion of these two structures. And it turns out, actually, that this reflects a much more general evolutionary relationship between the two structures. And that general evolutionary relationship makes an awful lot of sense in terms of connectional anatomy, because the cerebellum and cortex are massively interconnected via intermediate nuclei in the thalamus of the diencephalon and in the pons. Cortical projection, cerebellar projections are found throughout the neocortex. They're not restricted, as you might think, to motor cortex, but they're found through a very wide range of cortical areas. In primates as well, the evolution of foveal vision is associated with a unique cortico-cerebellar pathway. I've got to stay over here, I think. What am I doing wrong? I'll move around. I'll see if I can avoid it by moving around. And this is a plot for mammals, which shows that generally across mammals, the relative sizes of these two structures, having accounted for the size of other brain structures, shows a strong pattern of correlated evolution. So there's something interesting going on here in terms of cortico-cerebellar evolution. And Bryony Whiting and I had a look at this in more detail in primates and essentially replicated that finding within primates. But we also found that the patterns of correlated evolution very nicely match the connectional anatomy. So I won't go into all the detail, but this diagram essentially is a representation of the partial correlations in terms of the correlated evolution between particular structures. So partialing out variation in the rest of the brain, those structures in the cortico-cerebellar networks that are most strongly correlated with each other are those that have the most direct or the strongest connection. So there's a nice congruence between the anatomy and the evolution. And since this is supposed to be about new stuff, Jeroen Smeers has just published a follow-up study to ours in which what they did that was quite nice was to partition the cerebellum into more specific areas and show, once again, this is a similar kind of diagram to ours. Don't need to worry about the details, but again, the pattern of correlated evolution amongst different cortical and cerebellar regions closely matches the patterns of anatomy. And they also found that in their analysis, which was limited to frontal neocortex and posterior neocortex, that they showed rather different correlations to each other. In particular, frontal cortical areas were more strongly associated with basal ganglia than were the posterior areas. So this indicates that whilst the two structures have evolved together, there may be more specific systems within those structures that have been the focus of, that have been selected by natural selection. And again, if we look at this at the level of the number of neurons, we see really rather beautiful correlation between the relative number of neurons in the two structures once you've controlled for variation in neurons in other brain structures. So there's a specific relationship between these two structures. And also notable is that humans fall slap bang in the middle of this relationship. So humans are often outliers in plots of brain size and so on, but they really fit very neatly with this overall relationship. So what are these? What are all these neurons doing? What are these systems doing? This is just a summary, really, of the different cortical regions that have reciprocal connections with the cerebellum. And it's just to emphasize that not only is there a range of cortical regions implicated in this, but as you would expect, that there's a range of information processing capacities that are involved in those connections. And a lot of these are certainly things that, if you like to think of things in terms of executive and non-executive, you would have to classify as executive processes, but also I would argue processes that aren't easily categorized as one or the other, and that's something that I'll come back to. So more broadly speaking, one could characterize all of that in the following terms, I think. Corticocerebellar systems are intimately involved in sensory motor coordination, including the kinds of things that primates are particularly good at, fine-grained, complex sensory motor coordination, the planning of movements, learning, including complex sequences of behavior, and in general, the adaptive control of the animal in its environment, with, of course, the relevant sort of motivational or emotional modulation from limbic structures like the amygdala. Now, although I've been emphasizing that the cortex and cerebellum show strongly correlated evolution, that's a general pattern, you'll probably have noticed that it doesn't explain all the variation in each structure. And that suggests that there might be scope for independent variation in those two structures as well as correlated variation. And this is hot off Chris Venditti's computer, which is my excuse for why I haven't been able to make a prettier picture for you here. And don't worry that you can't read the labels on it. I just want to make a very simple point. What this is one of those sorts of analyses that Russell Gray was talking about, where you use Bayesian methods to infer rates of evolutionary change on branches of the phylogenetic tree. And this is an analysis for many species of mammals, but I've only been able to fit anthropoid primates onto the slide, and that's fine for emphasizing what I want to emphasize here, which is that when you look at the rate of evolutionary increase in the cerebellum, you see a dramatic increase in this clade, which is the apes. Okay, so gibbons, and in particular the great apes, including humans. And that increase in the rate of cerebellar evolution, the increase in the cerebellum, is greater than one sees for the neocortex, and that's the equivalent clade down here. So cerebellar specialization seems to have been particularly important in great apes, including humans. And this fits rather well, A, with what we know about the cerebellum, but also what we know about great ape behavior and great ape intelligence. Great apes are, of course, renowned for their complex foraging skills, their extractive foraging, where they have to, where they're presented with a food kind type that is difficult to extract from some kind of embedded substrate or requires extensive processing to get at the nutritious parts. And of course, sometimes they use tools to do this. They're not the only primates to do it, but they probably have the most elaborate behavioral patterns associated with these foraging tasks. That's associated with, of course, fine sensory motor control, but it's also associated with relatively complex sequences of behavior in which you have iterated multi-stage action patterns to solve what Dick Byrne has alluded to as a kind of syntactical problem in which you have to do things in the right sequence in order to get the right endpoint. And the cerebellum is just the sort of thing in terms of its functions in motor planning and learning that should be able to support that kind of behavior. So far, I've been emphasizing the sort of technical intelligence side of things. Social intelligence is a completely different talk, so I haven't got time to do that one today, but I think it's only fair to mention it, and in particular, to look at how the social intelligence and technical intelligence might interact. We can't, of course, ignore the comparative evidence for the social intelligence hypothesis and the fact that the size of the neocortex shows a very nice correlation with social group size, as has been shown by many studies by Robin Dunbar. But I think recently there has been, to some extent, some kind of challenge to this, not a fundamental challenge, but a challenge in terms of people suggesting that there are other things going on as well. And great apes, in particular, the social intelligence hypothesis may not be the obvious explanation for what's going on with them. They don't live in particularly large groups compared with monkeys, for example. And another challenge has come from people like Simon Reeder and colleagues, who've noted that from comparative studies, different sorts of behavioral and cognitive capacities seem to correlate with each other. And they explain this in terms of a kind of non-specialized general intelligence that underlies both social and technical domains. So given these queries, these challenges, if you like, I decided to go back to the brain size data and look anew at the correlates of brain size using the sort of new generation of phylogenetic methods. And I've, this is something I've done while I've been here at All Souls. And essentially, what we find is, if we look at brain size relative to body size, we find that it correlates with both social group size and independently with a measure of extractive foraging, which Simon Reeder kindly provided for me. So it looks like there is more than just sociality driving the evolution of brain size here. Interestingly, the correlates apply to both the cerebellum and the neocortex. Now, if we sometimes said that, well, it's just whole brain size, everything sort of goes together. And that's not quite true, because if you control for variation in the size of other brain structures, you still recover significant correlations between these two structures and both group size and extractive foraging. That's the first point. And the second point is that there is some hint here of a dissociation between the two structures in relation to the two behavioral measures, in that the cerebellum correlates strikingly strongly with extractive foraging, whereas the correlation for the cortex is stronger with group size. So I don't think there's anything here. Robin's somewhere here, I think. I don't think there's anything here for Robin to be concerned about. I think the social brain hypothesis is still alive and kicking, but I think that there's some other interesting things going on here as well. Now, the role of corticocerebellar systems in complex, organized, planned sequences of behavior suggests an obvious link to tool use, which is clearly something that is of interest to students of human evolution. And the role of the cerebellum in these kinds of behaviours, there are multiple lines of evidence, really, as to why we should expect the cerebellum to be involved. For example, there's clinical evidence that shows that the integrity of the cerebellum is necessary for the kind of seamless integration of separate movements within a skillfully executed and coordinated whole. And Dietrich Stout and his colleagues have found that there are sort of increased demands for effective visuomotor coordination and the hierarchical organization of behaviors in sequences with more advanced tool making. So comparing different more advanced and more simple tool making technologies. And that kind of emphasis on the hierarchical organization of sequences of behavior fits quite nicely with Dick Byrne's ideas about great apes, but presumably in hominin evolution, that has been taken even further. One of the areas activated in Stout's studies of brain imaging associated with tool use is Broca's area, and Stout argues that tool making and language share a common basis in capacities for complex goal-directed action sequences. So there's a suggestion that there may be that the sociality and technical intelligence may not be completely separate domains. There may be interactions between them. And Byrne and Bates have argued that the ability of great apes to learn new manual routines by passing action components, I've highlighted that in bold to make a link to the idea of syntax, may have driven their qualitatively greater social skill, suggesting that strict partition of physical and social cognition is likely to be misleading. And I think there's likely to be something in that. Byrne has also suggested that there may be a link between these kinds of complex technical skills and social learning and metacognition, the capacity to be able to read in some sense or understand the behavior of others. Now, great apes are not only very good at executing these kinds of complex technical skills, at interacting in sophisticated ways with difficult to extract food items, but also, as the work of people like Andy Whiten has shown, at learning how to do it by observation of others using apparatus like this, which is designed to kind of simulate an extractive foraging task. Well, it is an extractive foraging task. And it may be that there is an intrinsic link between the capacity to learn individually how to solve problems like this and how to learn them socially. And indeed, there's increasing interest in the idea that there are linkages between the brain systems, the neural systems, for performing these kinds of actions, or performing actions generally, and for the social perception and understanding of actions. And an example of that, which I won't have time to talk about, is the phenomenon of mirror neurons, where there is activation of individual neurons, or in the case of brain imaging studies of brain areas, when an individual performs an action, and also when it sees another individual performing that same action. It's been suggested that embodied simulation is a good term for the capacity to represent the behavior of others by firing up the same neural systems involved in executing that action. And increasingly, I'm going to emphasize this idea of simulation as being an important component of corticocerebellar processing. So the capacity to perceive, model, empathize with, and anticipate the behavior of others, as I say, seems to be at least in part related to the firing up the same neural systems in performing an action or observing that action. And Ostop et al. Developed a computational model that showed that computational elements developed for sensory motor control seem to be effective in inferring the mental states of others. So there's a very direct link being made here between sensory motor processes and inferring mental states. Given what I've been saying about the cerebellum and the role of sensory motor, the link between sensory motor processes and understanding others, it's perhaps no surprise that relatively recently neural mirror type activity has been found in the cerebellum. And here's just a couple of examples of that. For example, individuals that experience pain and that observe a loved one experiencing pain, in both cases, you get cerebellar activation. And there are now a number of studies showing similar phenomena in terms of cerebellar activation. I think, you know, this is quite interesting because until recently, people had really, again, like the evolutionary biologists, focused on the cortex as a site of this kind of activity. And gradually, it became apparent that interesting things were going on in other structures, particularly the cerebellum, and gradually people have started to actually make more of it. And some of the early papers mention of cerebellar activation was kind of buried in supplementary information, maybe because it just didn't fit with the way that people were conceptualizing the whole sort of mirror neuron phenomenon. But I think it makes an awful lot of sense in terms of the link to sensory motor processes. Now, I hope Celia will forgive me for stealing her slide again. This is the slide she put together as a kind of representation of the putatively unique human cognitive processes. And when I saw this, one of the things that struck me was how many of these processes seem to accord with the processes that we know the cerebellum to be involved in. And I've already talked about syntactic processing or syntactic type processing, the sequencing of behaviors in a regular order. And fine motor control, of course. But causal cognition could be conceptualized in the same kind of way as being the capacity to put sequences of things into an order and make inferences about them. Similarly, foresight and planning, again, essentially here, what's involved is the ordering of events and the capacity to represent the order of events. When we think about the future and when we plan for the future, essentially what we're doing is simulating, or it could be argued what we're doing is simulating processes or sequences of complex sequences of actions or events. Okay, and I've talked about theory of mind and imitation as possibly being linked as well. Okay, so how much time have I got? Okay, so it's probably not enough time to go into this in detail, luckily for you and probably for me. I'll put it up really to emphasize a couple of points. Firstly, you know, that I'm a serious kind of guy who reads the neuroscience literature. Seriously, this idea of the cerebellum as being engaged in sensory motor simulations and through its interaction with cortex fits very nicely with a recent model of the cerebellum. Ramnani published this model a few years ago. Essentially, the couple of take-home messages. One is that the emphasis on these parallel cortico-cerebellar pathways, in which, in his argument, is that what the cerebellar contribution to this is, it's quite complex, but essentially what it's doing is comparing what's going on in the cortical motor system. So this is the kind of functional model, and this is the anatomy over here. So the blue is the cortical side of things. And the cerebellar pathways are comparing what's going on in the cortical pathways with experience, with learning that's already been done, and updating the model. And also he's arguing that it's simulating the neural processes that are going on in the cortex. So the cerebellum, as engaged in a kind of simulation of cortical processes, is one aspect of this. And then the other aspect of this is that this bit is about sort of motor processes, but Ramnani argues that fundamentally the same architecture is duplicated across all the cortico-cerebellar pathways, or that you remember that I showed you all the different cortical areas that are implicated in this. And you've got the same fundamental neural architecture, presumably supporting the same kinds of algorithms. So there's a fundamental, although you have specialization in terms of the specific kinds of processes that are going on within those separate pathways, and there's also an underlying commonality in terms of the neural architecture and the computations that they're doing. Now, one of the aspects of Ramnani's model is that the cerebellum is absolutely crucial for a wide range of learning. And it's therefore quite intriguing that the cerebellum takes a very long time to mature postnatally. These are data for macaques, which shows that showing the increase in volume after birth. And the cerebellum really takes off after birth. And similarly in humans, the cerebellum only starts to level out after 3 years of age and plateau off about 4 years of age. So it's tempting to speculate that cerebellar maturation is critical in behavioral plasticity, in the learning and development of complex skills of a wide variety. Okay, so I've been talking about cortico-cerebellar systems. Obviously, the cortex is one half of that story. I want to just mention that the frontal lobes are a part of that story too, but it doesn't really fit the conventional wisdom about the frontal lobes. So it's folk wisdom that the frontal lobes have become disproportionately expanded during human evolution. I know this is folk wisdom because I asked my mother and she said that she thought it was true. But interestingly, a lot of scientists seem to think it's true as well, even in the face of their own data, which doesn't show that. So, you know, my argument would be that yes, the frontal lobes are terribly important, do all sorts of interesting things, but they've expanded conjointly with other structures, including the cerebellum. And as a consequence, what you don't see when you plot the size of frontal cortex against the size of other brain structures, you don't see the human data points which are here falling above that line of best fit, as would be predicted by the hypothesis of disproportionate expansion. Yet, you know, people still manage to interpret a pattern like that as there being something special about the frontal cortex in terms of its volumetric evolution. Area 10, a particular frontal area, again, falls bang on the line of best fit. Humans fall bang on the line of best fit. Rather giving the lie to the claim in the paper that area 10 in the human brain appears to be specialized in size. Now, I collected, again, while I was at All Souls, I collected all the data I could find on frontal lobe size, comparative frontal lobe size, redid all the analyses phylogenetically. So what these are is plots of phylogenetically controlled regressions. So the lines here are phylogenetically controlled regressions from which humans have been excluded and then mapped back onto the regression to see where they fall. The 95% confidence limits for independent data sets, humans fall within the 95% confidence intervals in each case. So, yes, frontal lobes, no doubt important. disproportionately expanded, not if you use a properly scaled measure. So why have we been so obsessed with the frontal lobes? Why do people tend to believe that they are the sort of be-all and end-all of human cognition and human cognitive evolution? I suspect that it's something to do with us thinking about thinking in the wrong kind of way. That we're still expecting to find somewhere in the brain where there's kind of this fella sitting up there reflecting on the sensory input that he gets in, wondering what to do about it and making plans for the future. In other words, that we're still kind of slightly wedded to a rather dualist kind of view of cognition and cognitive evolution, that the cognition is somehow separate from the sensory motor processes and the visceral and emotional processes that mediate adaptive behavior. But of course, brains didn't evolve to enable us to reflect about the universe or to construct veridical representations of the world and then reflect about those. They evolved to mediate adaptive behavior. And I really like Rodolfo Linas's example that rather nicely demonstrates this, C-squares. Now, I try to persuade my colleagues on the project during these last 2 months that C-squirts are really interesting, and I'm afraid I miserably fail, but I'll try with you. Linas points out that because there are two life history stages in C-squirts, one in which they have this tadpole-like free swimming form, they swim around, and then they find a nice place to settle down, find a rock or something, invert themselves, go head down, and attach themselves to a rock, become sessile, and absorb their own brain. And I think Linas may be right to suggest that this tells us something fundamental about what the function of brains is. It's to mediate adaptive behavior, to enable the animal to move around and interact with its world in adaptive ways. If you don't need to do that, then you don't need a brain. And it's also linked quite nicely with the views of people like Andy Clark, who says that the biological mind is first and foremost an organ for controlling the biological body. Minds make motions, and they must make them fast, before the predator catches you or before your prey gets away from you. Minds are not disembodied logical reasoning devices. So I would support Andy Clark's contention there that we must get away from this view of minds as disembodied logical reasoning devices. We must expand our view of what cognition is and get away from the idea of a fundamental separation between sensory motor and cognitive processes. And again, Rodolfo Linas has quite a nice way of talking about this. He conceives thinking as internalized movement. A reconstruction of possible movements and their possible consequences becomes, in fact, the substrate of thinking. So again, what he's talking about here is some kind of simulation of action patterns, sequences of behavior, or sequences of events. So that's my kind of polemic about dualism. In conclusion, I think there's good evidence from the empirical analysis of brain evolution that connectivity influences, though it doesn't wholly determine, it influences the way that individual brain structures evolved. And in terms of human to some extent also non-human brain evolution, corticocerebellar specialization seems to have been a crucial aspect of the evolutionary increase in brain size. I want us to pay more attention to the cerebellum, please. This debate about the specific versus general mechanisms, I think my position from, inferred from all of this, is it's kind of a bit of both. Things aren't as specific, certainly, as some evolutionary psychologists would have us believe. We have specific mechanisms. We can see from the evidence of brain evolution, the evolution of specific kinds of sensory motor specializations, but they have some generality in the way they're applied. And also they have computational commonalities. Different systems have fundamentally similar neural architectures. And finally, I'd argue for a kind of continuity between processes that we think of as cognitive and those that we think of as sensory motor.